There are some things in life that just shouldn't be forgotten, like bringing your keys when you leave the house, setting your fantasy lineup, and most importantly, having Hidden Valley Ranch to watch the game. Especially if you're having pizza. Those creamy, zesty, cool ranch flavors take each cheesy, melty bite to an unforgettable level. Hidden Valley Ranch. Only serious about flavor.
Off the ball. GAA.
The game is much more progressive. It's been much more engaging for people to watch and more entertaining for supporters.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
John Feinstein is one of the greatest American sports writers over the last 20 or 25 years. The author of a number of best-selling sports books, including A Season on the Brink. But he's maybe best known for his book about golf, A Good Walk Spoiled, with a little nod there to Mark Twain. And that's what we're interested in focusing on right now. I'm delighted to welcome John to the show. John, I want to talk first of all about the final round of Q School, because I have to say, this is part of the book. It goes on to deal with other issues, and you follow the entire top rank of players around the USPGA Tour for one whole year. But the stuff about qualifying from Q School is incredible. It's the pressure of guys having a putt for their very career. Was this always going to be part of the plan, or was it more of an afterthought?
No, I really, Owen, wanted it to be a part of the book because covering golf and covering all sports, I've always sort of been conscious of the struggle. The fact that not everybody is Nick Faldo or Tiger Woods or Greg Norman or Phil Mickelson, that most people are Paul Goidos or most people are Brian Henninger, if they're lucky to be that good. And so I went into the book really with a game plan to kind of start at the Ryder Cup, which in many ways is golf's ultimate event because it's watched by the entire world, certainly watched by everybody in the United States and Europe, and then contrast that with Q School a couple of months later, with guys who would just like to have a chance to play on the tour. And it's interesting that you say what you did about the Q School aspect of the book, because without any doubt, that was the part of the book people commented to me the most about, and people have still talked to me about all these years later. The book's been out 11 years. And really, I just went back this past year and did an entire book that'll be out next spring in 2007 on just Q School. All three stages of Q School, because as you mentioned in A Good Walk Spoiled, I only covered the final, which is the last six rounds. Q School in the United States is three stages for most players, and I did an entire book on Q School, and I have to tell you, it was a fascinating experience, but it was certainly my doing A Good Walk Spoiled that inspired me to do the book that'll be out next spring.
When you were watching these guys putting on the final green for a chance to actually achieve their dream and a chance to follow their career, did it feel like voyeurism to you at times?
You know, that's a very good point. It did. Because when you're at Q School, there's very few other people there. There are no ropes. And you know, I just walked down the fairway with the guys that I was following. And a little bit, you almost wanted to avert your eyes at times. When they were in trouble or lining up a crucial putt, and you didn't want to feel as if you were kind of the albatross around their neck as they went around, especially on those last couple of days when so much was at stake. But yeah, absolutely, because you can't blend into the crowd at Q School, Owen.
Yeah.
It's pretty much you and the birds and the bees and the players and the caddies.
Was that one of the things that interested you most when you were watching these guys under such pressure, that different human beings reacted in different ways?
Yeah, and again, that's one of the things that always has fascinated me about sport, that really, in the end, it is about people. That's what I write about. I don't write so much about the games or the results or, you know, the birdies and the bogeys. I write about the people and how it affects their lives, success and failure, and how they react to success and failure. So it was interesting that, you know, there were some guys who I got very close to, a number of these guys, and both in A Good Walk Spoiled and in this more recent book. And there are some guys, you know, who actually want you close. They want someone to talk to. They want a way to kind of vent during the course of a round. And there are other guys you sort of knew, stay back, stay out of their way, give them their space, because they really don't want anybody that close to them, including their, you know, their wife. So you get to know the personalities of the people and kind of how to deal with them as they're going through this pressure cooker.
You mentioned the wife there. What sort of approaches do most of these young guys take? And I say young guys, that's not necessarily fair. Some of them might be older than guys who are already on tour, but people who qualify and finally get a full tour card, they're obviously, they don't have the money to be flying in private jets around to these various events. And America is a big country. It is a big tour. Do they generally take their families on the road with them, or do they stay away from their families for weeks on end? How does that work?
the way it works for most guys is that when their kids get to school age, they stay home during the school year, and then they try to travel with them during the course of the summer when the kids are out of school. When there are no kids, it's obviously easier. It's just you and your wife or you and your girlfriend, whatever it might be. But once kids come into the picture, it complicates things. And as you know, golfers peak later than most athletes. Many golfers have their best years in their 30s and even into their 40s when they have started families. You know, most athletes, for example, most of the basketball players here in our country, they're in the NBA when they're 19, 20, 21 years old, and many of them are done by the time they're 30 and think about starting a family. Whereas in golf, you might just be starting at 30 when you're starting your family. So it is more complicated, and most of them, you're right, aren't making the kind of money where they can just, you know, hire a private jet and rent a big house for the weekend. Frequently, they're squeezed into motel rooms, you know, with crying babies, and it's not nearly as glamorous a life as you might think just watching it on television.
You mentioned that part of your aim was to build relationships with players, and that seemed to happen both with those guys who came on tour for the first time through Q School and also with some of the bigger names. The respect you have for these people kind of bounces off the pages. Were they very cooperative from the beginning, and were you surprised with how much access you got? Because that really was the key to this book in many ways.
They were cooperative, Owen. And I think part of it with the American players, it helped that I had done a couple of basketball books, and a lot of them are big basketball fans, so they knew my name. And that helped. But I also think that golfers as a group sort of understand what we in the media do. And it was a complete contrast for me having done a tennis book a few years earlier, Hard Courts, where, you know, trying to get 10 minutes with a tennis player is about as easy as, you know, winning the lottery. You have to beg and plead and cajole, even if you know the guys. Whereas with most of the golfers, I often tell the story that the first time I introduced myself to Nick Price, now he didn't know me from Adam, and I walked up, introduced myself, said I was doing a book on life on the tour, and he was the number one player in the world at the time, remember. And he said, look, I don't know what my schedule's going to be for next year yet. Can you call me in a couple weeks? I'll know my schedule. We'll set up a time to get together. And he gave me a phone number. So a couple weeks later, I called the number. I expected to get his agent or a secretary or something. Nick picked up the phone. It was his home phone number, you know, which he gave to a complete stranger. And I think golfers just kind of get what we do. And the great advantage I had, obviously, Owen, was being out there week after week after week. Even those that didn't know me, after a while, they became very familiar with my face and my being around, and they understood what I was doing. And I think that's the way I was able to develop the trust that I developed during the course of the book.
Even allowing for that, though, I would have thought, John, that it would be difficult to get somebody like, say, Nick Faldo to open up.
Yeah, I think, again, that I was fortunate there in that I didn't have to kind of club rush him and say, I need you right now. I was able to give him some flexibility. I think the first time I talked to him was early in 94, and we didn't have our first long sit-down until the Memorial, which was in May of that year. And then, you know, I was able to kind of coax him to go out to dinner. And I don't think I asked an interview question for the first hour. You know, we just talked. And again, you have that luxury doing a book that you don't have to talk to someone today. I've been a newspaper man for years, and there are times when a guy shoots a bad round or has a bad day, you've got no choice. You've got to go talk to him anyway. You've got to ask him about what happened with that triple bogey on 17. But when you're doing a book, if a guy has a bad day, you can sort of lay back. You can say, you know, I know we were supposed to have lunch today, but if you want to postpone it till tomorrow or next week, that's fine with me. And they sort of appreciate that you understand that. And I was able to do that, you know, with a lot of the players. And with Faldo, I was able to kind of work my way in to the point where I think by the time we got to the British Open and the PGA that year, he felt pretty comfortable with me.
So much of what we want to do can seem impossible, but the highest achievers among us are the people still reaching for something, the ones who aren't satisfied to stay where they are and want to keep climbing higher. It's those people who approach the impossible and embrace it. There's a vehicle for people like that. It's called the Defender. The Defender is an icon reimagined through thoroughly modern design. It's got a tough, rigid body design and durable, lightweight monocoque architecture for extra strength. With precise detailing and compelling proportions, the exterior of the Defender is designed with integrity. This is a vehicle capable of great things, engineered to meet challenges head-on with an exterior that's been tested to the extreme. Experience the Defender's legendary capability, off-road and on. And there's a family of vehicles for Defender. Meet the Defender 90, Defender 110, and the 8-seat Defender 130. So, are you ready to embrace the impossible? Explore the Defender at LandRoverUSA.com.
There are some things in life that just shouldn't be forgotten, like bringing your keys when you leave the house, setting your fantasy lineup, and most importantly, having Hidden Valley Ranch to watch the game. Especially if wings are on the menu. Those creamy, zesty, cool ranch flavors take each spicy, savory bite to an unforgettable level. Hidden Valley Ranch, only serious about flavor.
You didn't exactly make friends with everybody. I think it's fair to say, reading the book, that John Daly wasn't somebody who you had a huge amount of time for. What exactly, how do you feel John Daly came across in your book?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story with John and I, because he didn't come across well in A Good Walk Spoiled. You're 100% right. He was going through a period where he'd been in and out of rehab, and he was really kind of bitter at that point, which happens. My mother was an alcoholic, so I understand about alcoholism and how people react when they have to go through rehab, when interventions are done and things like that. And John was kind of angry with people. You know, that was the year he made the claim about that a lot of people on the tour were using drugs, and he got in trouble for that. And he quit in the middle of a tournament in Hawaii and got in trouble for that. And he was a quitter at that point in his career. And it was very hard to respect that aspect of him. And I think that came through in the book. But interestingly, when I did my next golf book, The Majors, a few years later, John had an incident at Bay Hill where he made an 18, if you can believe it, on a hole. And after the round, stood and answered every question, didn't storm off, didn't stalk away from people. And the next day, I walked up to him on the range, and I said to him, you know, I know you and I had our differences when I was doing A Good Walk Spoiled, but I have to tell you, I really respect the way you handled that situation yesterday. And he and I ended up becoming friends. And if you ever were to read The Majors, you could see he's a prominent part of that book. So we get along fine now, but back then we certainly were not close.
Was a part of your problem, part of the issue you might have had with John Daly at that time, the type of support that he brought to the game, the kind of get-in-the-hole brigade, I suppose you might call them? And might it be fair to say that the sort of wheels he set in motion there were furthered when Tiger Woods came into the game? Because part of the interesting aspect of this book, it's just before Tiger takes over, and it's a different sort of a game. Do you think maybe that the sort of new fans that John Daly brought to the game didn't necessarily mix too well with the real knowledgeable golf fans, and maybe more of those were brought in during Tiger Woods?
Well, I think, you know, on the one hand, it's great to bring new people to the game, and John did that, and Tiger has certainly done that. And I think that's good for golf. You broaden the game, and you bring new fans in, and hopefully they gain an appreciation for what's great about golf. But I will say that walking around at times with John's galleries back then in 93 and 94, you did understand that there were people out there who didn't know a golf ball from a tennis ball. And they were there to drink beer and scream "You to man." And you know, and again, there's nothing wrong with having fun. But there were times when it was very difficult for some of the other players who were paired with John. That wasn't John's fault.
Mm.
John wasn't at fault for that at all. But sometimes it did get a little bit out of hand, and occasionally, you know, these days it gets a little bit out of hand with Tiger, but you certainly can't knock all the new fans that the two of them have brought to the game.
You were quoted before saying, regarding golfers, nobody tackles you, nobody dunks on you, so when you fail, there's no excuse. That's very hard to deal with mentally. Do you think you were successful in getting inside the heads of the players and letting the readers know, stripping them bare to a certain extent psychologically and letting the readers see underneath?
I think that the readers would be a better judge of that than I. That was certainly my goal. My goal is always to kind of take the readers to places they haven't gone before, whether it's inside someone's head or inside the ropes or inside the locker room or out onto the range, to give them a feel for that. And, you know, the way people responded to A Good Walk Spoiled, I think they, you know, readers did feel that they got to go places in terms of their understanding of golfers and what it takes to be successful that perhaps they hadn't gone before. And what was really flattering to me, Owen, was the number of people in golf, players and officials and sponsors, who said to me that they learned things about the tour and about golf and life on the tour that they hadn't learned before from reading the book. That was very flattering.
Did you find maybe part of the most interesting things to write about in some ways were the Curtis Stranges of this world? Because Strange obviously won two majors in 88 and 89 and then never won a tournament again. This
right.
is, in a way, do you think that maybe readers, especially people who mightn't be great golfers themselves, actually like to read about guys like this who just lose it and can never regain that touch?
I think one of the reasons that golf is as popular as it is that even hackers can identify with the struggles that the best players go through, because even the best players do struggle. I mean, Tiger makes it look easy a lot of the time, but then he had that 2-year period where he couldn't keep the ball on the planet. And Tiger Woods, for God's sake. So it's not unusual to see a guy like Curtis Strange lose it, or guys who've been, you know, when I did the Q School book this past year, there were 23 guys playing in the finals and another 19 who had to play second stage who had won at least once on the PGA Tour. And that's a level of success that not that many people get to.
My second recommendation, folks, is A Good Walk Spoiled. I don't know if you've read it, lads, but John Feinstein wrote this in, it's funny enough, 1994, after spending a year on the US PGA Tour, including the major championships and including the Open at Turnberry, which is now owned by Trump. And it's funny, he's talking about the Japanese making a big play for, you know, the Turnberry at the time. And why I really like this book is because I couldn't get enough of it and I wanted more. I would love to see every 3 to 4 years a diary of the tour and the access John Feinstein got. He got Davis Love, Tom Kite, Greg Norman. This is before the Tiger Woods era, of course, John Cook. And you remember he's speaking to like players that struggled, like Paul Goyos and Brian Henninger through Q School and that. Lee Jansen. He talks about the Ryder Cup of the Belfry, which the Americans won. You got Tom Watson interviewed, Nick Faldo's interviewed in it. And the access is incredible. And I talk about the Masters and the rituals and the traditions there. And the really, I don't think it's really changed that much, although they've let women in now and Tiger Woods has changed golf and has changed sport. But even just the way they run the Masters, that is their tournament, and even the Open Championship when Nick Price won it that year. And just the access, and I'd love to, and the reason why, and I won the William Hill Sports Book of the Year, and it's just beautifully written, and everything is very tight in the book, and everything is very precise and correct, and it's really, like, because I knew that 94 tournament, I watched it on TV, that is really, really tight, but really well told, little anecdotes in there about the way the Americans hated going to Scotland, and they hated the showers and all that kind of thing, and they hated the Open Championship, and when they got there, they loved it. But wouldn't you love to just see a tour diary of Rory McIlroy, Dustin Johnson, Brooks Koepka, Tiger Woods, access to them all, like the way the year builds, and I think that's what we were speaking earlier on about a boxing match that builds or a week, or Neil saying about the Super Bowl week. Wouldn't you love to see a diary of the tour, no holds barred, of every golfer's story that year? That's why I picked John Feinstein's A Good Walk Spoiled for my number two.
I was just going to say, John, like John Feinstein is I have a few of his books on my shelf. A Good Walk Spoiled is one of the few of his that I actually haven't read. The one I'm actually on right now is one of his as well. I think I mentioned it on last week's show. I'm only in the early stages of it now, but it's Where Nobody Knows Your Name. It's actually a really, really interesting story. Life in the minor leagues of baseball. So he's basically connected up with about 7 or 8 different characters, and they're from all walks of life in baseball. So like there are a couple of players, there are a couple of coaches there. He has umpires, people like that, people who are constantly flirting between trying to get out of the minor leagues and get their like 15 minutes of fame in the big leagues. And it's a really, really interesting story. There are also a couple of great basketball books that he would have written as well down the years. One that's always on the list of the great American sports books is A Season on the Brink. He basically follows Bob Knight, the famous Indiana basketball coach, for an entire season. And Bob Knight is at this stage where he's an all-time legend at this university, but he'd been there a long, long time. And he's getting to the point where his star is suddenly starting to fade and he's under all sorts of pressure, and somehow through this madness manages to cobble together not quite a winning season, but a season that nobody expected from this team that was on the wane. And he's just a fascinating character as well. And he's also written a great book called The Legends Club, which is about it's quite niche. It's about the kind of the famous basketball triangle in North Carolina between North Carolina State, North Carolina, and Duke University. And they're just a couple of brilliant books that he's an author, I think, down the years that I've dipped back to every now and again.
It is time for our Tuesday night book of the week, which lays claim to being the best-selling sports book of all time, certainly one of my favourites. Published in 1987, A Season on the Brink is a fly-in-the-wall account of a season with the Indiana Hoosiers college basketball team and their controversial coach Bob Knight, a man who'd make even the younger Alex Ferguson seem like a bit of a pussycat. Knight has just retired from the sport in the last few days, having long since established himself as one of the most successful coaches ever. The author of A Season on the Brink is the brilliant John Feinstein, who's also responsible for the great golf book A Good Walk Spoiled. among many others. And he joins me on the line now. Before we get to John, though, here's a little flavour of what the man himself was all about. He certainly, his quotes over the years show that he wasn't exactly the easiest person to deal with and certainly didn't have too much time for the media pack.
Let me answer that. You know, that is an absolute crock of you know, you people in the news media, all of you dwell on some negative piece of like that. And I don't know how Steve feels about it, but it just and you don't have to bleep one single word of this.
If it amazes you, then you don't know anything about basketball. You're illuminating your relative lack of knowledge of the game with a statement like that. Let's just start all this again. Now, I'm not here to argue the thing with you. I'm not going to debate things with you and people from television. No, you want to answer from me, you get the answer. You don't like an answer, then don't use the program, okay?
Who the hell told you I wasn't going to be here? I'd like to know. Do you have any idea who it was?
Yeah, I do, Coach.
Who?
I'll point them out to you in a while.
They were from Indiana, right?
No, they're not.
No, weren't from Indiana, and you didn't get it from anybody from Indiana, did you?
Could we please...
No, I'll handle this the way I want to handle it now that I'm here. You f***ed it up to begin with. Now just sit there or leave. I don't give a what you do. Now, back to the game.
Yeah, that was Bob Knight there, just retired 20 years on from the time that A Season on the Brink was written by John Feinstein. John, for people who aren't overly familiar, they might have got a bit of an idea there with this man. What was his public persona like? What was he all about?
Well, I think the public persona, Owen, is very mixed in that he is a paradox, both in public and in private. There is a good side of Bob Knight that is very good. He obviously a great coach, the all-time winningest college basketball coach in history in the United States. Won 3 national championships while he was the coach at Indiana University. Won an Olympic gold medal in 1984. Unlike many of the top coaches who win a lot of games, his players almost always graduated. He never broke the rules, and he could be a very generous and charming person. But the other side of Bob Knight is a bully, someone who frequently got into trouble because of his temper. He was arrested in Puerto Rico while coaching the U.S. Pan American team in 1979 for an incident with a policeman. He stuffed a fan into a trash can during another incident in 1981. He famously threw a chair across the court during a game in 1985. He choked a player and then denied it in the late 1990s and eventually was fired at Indiana, in spite of the fact that he had such a superb record because of his behavior, and ended up coaching in Texas Tech, which is not exactly a basketball power. So he's been a paradox throughout his career, and I think that's a lot of the reason why people have been so fascinated with him, because they wonder, how can someone who can be so good be so bad? And that was really what I set out to try to find out when I went to research Season on the Brink a long, long time ago now.
Yeah, it was a long time ago, but so much of it probably would still ring true for people. And that chair incident that you mentioned, the rap sheet there you read out is just incredible. He seemed to get involved in so many of these incidents. The chair incident is probably quite interesting because it had happened a season or so before you went and spent a season with these guys recording every move. So I guess that was a huge thing at the time.
It was, because it was on television and everybody saw it, and it was replayed time after time after time. And it was, you know, so, I mean, it was just something you never imagine a coach doing. I mean, it's one thing for a coach to yell at referees and get, you know, called for a technical foul, you know, the equivalent of a yellow card in soccer or to, you know, even get thrown out of a game. But to pick up a chair and throw it that way. Now, as it happened, it didn't hit anybody. It went right by one of the players on the opposing team and across the court. But it was just so weird almost, because you don't see that kind of thing, that it really did sort of focus attention on just how out of control Bob Knight could be at times.
Tell us about his treatment of players, the bullying as you describe it there. He seems to just break these guys down psychologically and absolutely just rip them apart.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that, Owen, having observed it up close the way I did, is most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time when he was yelling at players or throwing them out of practice or whatever, there was a method to the madness. He was trying to accomplish something. He was trying to make a point to them. I remember one moment during that season when they'd lost a couple games in a row, and he was very frustrated with the way they were playing. And he walked into the locker room, and instead of shouting or showing them tape or making them go out and run sprints or whatever, he said to them, you know, I always tell you guys that you will not be successful as basketball players as long as you're selfish as people. And he said, and I don't mean by that passing the ball or helping on defense or whatever. I mean the way you live your lives. And he said to them, you know, on Thanksgiving Day, because college basketball players don't get to go home at Thanksgiving here in the States because they're getting ready to play games. On Thanksgiving Day, you went over to our team doctor's house for Thanksgiving dinner, all of you. And his wife cooked and cleaned the house and took care of you guys on the holiday when you were away from your families. Anybody in here who thanked her, sent her a letter, flowers, whatever, raise your hand. And not a hand went up. And he said, see, this is what I mean. As long as you live your lives as selfish people, you won't be good basketball players. And to me, that was kind of the essence of the good Bob Knight. The Bob Knight who taught and coached and helped make these kids better players and better people. And that's why so many of his players, I've always said, when you play for Knight, you swear at him. When you are finished playing for Knight, you swear by him. Because he does make you a better basketball player. He does make you a better person, although it can frequently be a very unpleasant experience.
I think that's a kind of fascinating point about Bob Knight, because it seems that he abuses a guy, particularly the more talented. You make the point throughout that a couple of the more talented guys on the team are the guys that tend to get a lot of the stick, because with less talented people, maybe he just understands that they're not good enough. It's frustrating. But when he sees people who should be good enough, he'll abuse them for 4 years and abuse them and abuse them. And then once they're out of the system and once they're finished in college, he'll tell the next batch, you've got to be like that last guy who was here. He was the best player that ever played for this school.
Right. I mean, I remember one night a player named Randy Whitman, who had played at Indiana prior to when I did the book, came back for a game. And in the locker room at halftime, Knight was furious. And he said, you know, if Randy Whitman was on this team, he wouldn't accept this kind of play. He'd be in your faces. He'd be telling you, this is unacceptable. And I repeated this to Whitman after the game, and he looked at me and he said, when I was here, I was the worst player in the history of Indiana basketball for 4 years. And I joked with Steve Alford, who was the star of that team, you understand, once you're not here, he will tell the players who come in the future that you were the greatest player he ever coached. Right now, you're the worst player he ever coached. That was his method.
You say people swear by him once they're gone. It seems that loyalty is a pretty big thing for him. And once the person is out of the school and he can treat them more as a peer, I suppose, he'll do anything to help them.
He will, and he is loyal that way, although he has kind of a skewed sense of loyalty. Sometimes it only runs in one direction. You know, a lot of the people he's been very close to, Mike Krzyzewski, the coach at Duke, and Alford, who played for him, and Jim Cruz, another guy who played for him and then coached under him for 8 years, he's had huge fights with at times over what he perceived as an act of disloyalty. Krzyzewski's act of disloyalty was to beat Indiana in the Final Four in 1992. They didn't talk for almost 10 years. So it can be a little bit strange with Bob at times, what he expects from you in return. But most of the time, if you have played for him, if you have coached for him, and you are in some kind of crisis, professional crisis, personal crisis, whatever it might be, he will probably be there to try to help you in any way he can.
Despite the fact that you put this all in the book, and it's plain to see that you're putting forward different sides of this fairly fascinating personality, I understand he wasn't too happy with the end product.
Although the irony, Owen, is that what he was upset about was that I left his profanity in the book. And I don't think there's anybody on this planet, and probably several people on Mars, who don't know that Bob Knight uses profanity all the time. And I had expected, because of the way he is, that he was going to find something not to like about the book. Bob Knight's not the kind of guy who was going to call me on the phone and say, hey, John, you did a great job. I expected there to be a complaint of some kind, but I never dreamed that it would focus on his profanity. I mean, saying Bob Knight uses profanity is like saying that, you know, the World Cup is a big deal in Europe. Everybody knows it. And yet, when I got a phone call from one of his assistant coaches and saying, well, coach is upset with you because you left his profanity in the book, I said, no, seriously, what's he upset about? I really thought the guy was joking, but he wasn't.
And did he make that perfectly clear to you, I would imagine, that he wasn't happy with it?
Oh, yes. I mean, he called me all sorts of names in print, and, you know, there was a big battle back and forth for a while. And 8 years later, I ran into him in a hotel lobby with another coach, a guy who coaches at Maryland named Gary Williams. And he started a conversation with me as if nothing had happened. Hi, John. How's it going? How's your family? And when he walked away, Gary Williams said to me, why, after all the things he called you, after all the names he called you, why would you speak to him? I said, because he built my house.
It does seem amazing. And the book would have only worked if you had his cooperation in the first place. This kind of book only works with warts and all kind of access. It must have been quite an enjoyable thing, I would imagine, getting so close to a sports team and to a manager like that for a season.
Well, it was a fascinating experience, because whenever you get to be up close and personal with someone who is the best at what they do, you learn. And you learn why they're successful. Sometimes you learn why they're at times not successful. I certainly learned that. But as a basketball fan, it was a fascinating experience. And you're 100% right. I said to Bob, you know, that winter, you need to understand that if I write this book and all it says are good things about you, it won't have any credibility. People will say, well, Knight gave Feinstein access and he wrote him a love letter. But if it shows both sides, then people will understand the good parts, and the good parts will have credibility. And he said, oh, yeah, I understand that completely. And then when the book came out, of course, he did.
Yeah, and he coached towards the end of his career, as you say, in Texas Tech, but it was Indiana, and again, for people who wouldn't be too familiar, they were a big school, and as you say, he won national titles with them. He was sacked for, was it any one particular thing, or was it just a build-up of a lot of what used to go on?
A build-up. It got to the point where he had an incident involving this player where he choked him in practice with one hand. I mean, I'm not defending it, but it was caught on tape. And after it came to light, the president of Indiana, a guy named Miles Brand, who's now the president of the NCAA, which oversees all of college athletics in the United States, announced that from now going forward, there would be zero tolerance in terms of Coach Knight's behavior because of all these incidents that had occurred. And Knight said, oh, I understand. It's no problem, no big deal. And a couple months later, he was walking by some kids on the campus, and one of the kids turned around and said, hey, Knight, how's it going? And Knight literally grabbed him and said, don't you ever call me Knight. You call me Coach Knight. And, you know, pushed the kid. Didn't hurt him, but did physically grab this kid. And that was it. That was the end.
It was 20 years ago that you wrote this book. He has been coaching all the time since and has just finished up in the last week or so. What's the reaction been generally to the retirement of this man?
Well, I think a little bit of a surprise because it came in the middle of the season. You always expect the great coaches to retire at the end of a season. But interestingly, in college basketball, some of our greatest coaches have stepped down during the season. Dean Smith, the great coach at North Carolina, announced his retirement the day before a season began. John Thompson, the coach at Georgetown, who coached the Olympic team in 1988, quit in the middle of the season, much like Knight did. Lefty Driesell, another very famous coach here, quit in the middle of the season. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that these very driven guys who really just can't stand losing wake up one morning and they look in the mirror and they say, in Knight's case, I'm 67. I'm not as good as I used to be. I'm not winning like I used to be. I don't want to do this anymore. And that's it. They're done. They shut down. And they walk away. So there was certainly surprise at the timing of it. And there were some people who, you know, accused him of quitting on his team. I really don't think he did that, Owen. I think he thought it was best for his team if his son Pat, who was taking over, who's young and has lots of energy, coached the team for the rest of the season rather than he did as someone who obviously felt tired and worn out after 42 years as a coach.